Hi, folks. Thank you so much for joining us here at Hearsay Culture. I'm Denise Howell, and this is Uneven Distribution, the show where we learn from the time travelers among us, those writing the plot lines of the future from right here in our present. Today, we're joined by Deb Donig, who co-leads the Ethical Technology Project at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and she hosts the Technically Human podcast. Deb, I've been so excited to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Denise. It's such an honor to be here.
I think it's fascinating the work you're doing, and I'm so grateful that you're doing it. You are someone who I think by the time we get to the end of this show, our entire audience is going to be very pleased to know is in the world doing what you're doing. Why don't you explain for us what the Ethical Technology Project at Cal Poly is?
Sure. So maybe the best way to really start is to start off my story about how I got to founding the Ethical Technology Initiative and what really drove me to build what I ended up building at Cal Poly. It really started many years before that. I wrote a dissertation on human rights in the 20th century. And what I realized is that you can't write about human rights in the 21st century without talking about things that involve technology, whether it is questions of human rights freedom of speech in social media, whether it is questions of what a social media company has potentially mobilized a genocide in Myanmar, or whether it's, you know, questions of our democracy being overrun by what I call algocracy or rule by algorithms, you have to sort of talk about tech. And so when I finished that first book manuscript on human rights, I really started thinking about the entanglement of human rights with technological production, technological culture, and technological products themselves. And then there was one specific event that I think mobilized me toward thinking about technology and the unintended consequences of technology. And that was, as I think it was for many people, the 2016 election. And in 2016, I think many of us who had been very overcome in utopian thinking ways about the benefits of technological production were suddenly confronted with what technological production had maybe been complicit in an outcome of an election that for many of us seemed disastrous, and that for many of us seemed to put the most vulnerable of our society in an increasingly vulnerable position. And so I started an organization in the Bay Area called Tech Stands Up. It was an organization that a number of people in tech helped to build as a way to give voice to and to push tech leaders to become vocal about protecting vulnerable people in tech. Everybody from farm workers who were supplying tech companies with the food that they were catering for their workers to things like the users who are suddenly becoming very vulnerable from these tech products and the ways that we were all maybe being faked by deep fakes, that we were all potentially having our private data exposed, something that I think we'll talk about later. And so I started thinking about this increasingly when I took the job at Cal Poly as an English professor. I wanted to bring that to the university. And increasingly, I saw that my humanities students were really excited to take classes on the ethics of technology because they could see how their skills could be mobilized toward the most potentially, I think, dominant feature of our country and our culture right now, which is tech. And that actually the folks coming in from engineering departments were really excited to learn about ethics and to understand the social complications and the, you know, problems that their work was entangled within. And right. So I got together with a couple of folks at Cal Poly. We thought, how can we build this into an actual curriculum? How can we build this into an actual field of study? And that was what the Ethical Technology Initiative aimed at doing. And I think that that is what we have been able to accomplish in ways that I could not have anticipated with outcomes that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, I think it's really fantastic the way that you're bringing people together across so many disciplines. When I look at your associated faculty that are involved in the Ethical Technology Project, you've got folks from communications, political science, social science, English, of course, architecture, philosophy. You've got some pretty cool niche disciplines at Cal Poly, such as philosophy, technology, and society. We've got science, technology, and society. You've got women's, gender, ethnic studies, and queer studies folks involved. Interdisciplinary studies and liberal arts. And let's see, Elise St. John is on here as a researcher and academic strategist, comma, digital. So you've got some really interesting folks from interesting backgrounds coming together to put their minds toward, it seems to me like what you're trying to do a little bit against the tide of common technological development is build better technologists as opposed to building better technologies per se. And maybe the better technologists will build better technologies. Does that kind of capsulize what you're up to there?
I think that that's crucial. I think the idea is, for me at least, that before we can build anything, we first have to imagine it. And so we have to really think critically about the terrain of the imagination and what it is we envision when we try and think of a better world. If we're all granularly locked into our specific expertise, then I don't think we have the capability of really thinking broadly about the impact and the calculus and the complications of how our technological products are intertwined with our society. And I also think that the problems that we're facing in the world today are so big and so complex that if we're just granularly locked into our specialized way of thinking, we have no chance of solving these problems. Take COVID, for example. COVID is a technological problem. It's a problem about, how you build a vaccine. But of course, it's also a policy problem. It is also a immunology problem. It is also a psychology problem. It's a problem. It's a problem about our cultural narratives, how we understand ourselves to relate to one another, what sort of obligations we have to other people versus what sort of individual freedoms we have. If you don't have expertise or people talking to one another across those areas of expertise, then we have no chance at solving these major problems. But I think that if we talk to one another across different tables, I think we do. And so for me, I want to bring as many people together to the table to talk about these things, because I think that this gives us the best chance of not only solving the problems, but doing so with human values and the complexity of human experiences in mind.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. And I look forward to seeing how you guys do and what you come up with and the students you produce under this rubric, who will go on obviously to become our next technologists or the folks advising them or regulating them one way or another. One of the things I wanted to explore with you, because back in the early 2000s, when I first started paying a lot of attention to technology, move fast, break things was the Silicon Valley mantra. It was hard to get away from. It was ask forgiveness, not permission, and solve problems and everything will fall into place for you. And I feel, just for fun, before we decided to do our show today, I wanted to see what the dialogue around move fast, break things online is. And I didn't find much. I found one guy in the VC arena who is encouraging students to put together ideas and pitch them before they have an actual solid product or service that they want to unleash on the world, with the notion that if they have piqued someone's interest and can get someone to take out their credit card, as he says, then they've got something that's worth pursuing. And they have the added motivation, now that they know someone wants to pay for this thing that they've envisioned, to go out and build it. What do you think of the current status of move fast, break things?
Right. So to historicize move fast and break things just in our immediate present, move fast and break things is probably most closely associated with Mark Zuckerberg's philosophy of Facebook. Now, on the level that you're talking about it here, which is the professor urging his students to kind of just build something quickly, test it out, see whether there's any traction on it, see whether it works, fail quickly. I actually don't see a problem with that as a method. I think that actually, you know, if I were advising anybody about how to start a business, I would say build it and see whether it works before, you know, throw your heart into it, try it out, give it everything you've got. And then, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. The problem with this is that when we're talking about technological companies, we're actually talking about products that don't, that scale very quickly, that oftentimes explode with growth because the incentive structure is to develop a product very quickly to kind of explode it and to develop it and then roll it out very quickly without thinking about the consequences. So when we're talking about the tech ecosystem, we're not talking about a professor urging his students to just kind of move fast and break things and test things out and fail quickly. What we're really talking about is something along the lines of what Mark Zuckerberg actually did, which is to build a system that very quickly expanded into the public without any thought of what the consequences would be. That is a problem of the incentive structure. That's the problem of the financial structure. That's the problem of venture capital structure, which is to mobilize ideas very quickly without thinking about in complicated ways what the outcomes of the unintended consequences of that product will be once it is rolled out to a very diverse public. Now, I want to take a second as well to go back and historicize this idea of move fast and break things a little further, because I think it's important to think about how our culture got to the point of, you know, a social media company that had the vision of connecting the world without a real thought about what the world actually looks like when it is connected in that way, which is, as we were seeing, breaking out into identity politics and vociferous, ugly debates, not this kind of harmonious idea that Mark Zuckerberg had idealized and that he had, I think, envisioned from his Silicon Valley enclave. This idea of move fast and break things is not new to technological culture. This is not like a, you know, post-2000s movement. We really think about that idea of move fast and break things. One question we have to ask is, well, why did move fast and break things become a kind of mantra in Silicon Valley specifically? What is it about Silicon Valley that is so attracted to this idea of move fast and break things? And one way that we could start to answer that question is actually to look at what the West was and what the space of Silicon Valley as part of the American West has always envisioned itself to be. So you might ask yourself the question, why didn't Silicon Valley happen in Boston? Why didn't Silicon Valley happen in New York? Because, you know, there's a couple of really good schools in Boston that produce a lot of really thoughtful, smart engineers. Same thing with New York. So why Silicon Valley? Because it's got a couple of good schools in Silicon Valley, but nowhere close to the ecosystem of good kind of engineer production, you might say, in Boston. The answer is intellectual property law in California. Intellectual property law in California was much more lax than it was in a place like Boston and a place like New York, so that if you were working in a company in Silicon Valley, you could leave your company on a Friday and get a new job on a Monday. This is exactly what happened. People would get fed up with their company. They wouldn't like the CEO. They would have an idea that they wanted to start on their own, and they would just take the intellectual property, start a new company. You couldn't do that in Boston or New York. So the intellectual property law in California is part of what has enabled this move fast and break thing culture. But it even goes deeper than that, because if we take a couple of historical steps back, we start to think about, well, the West was really envisioned as the final frontier of the United States. When you think about the West, you think about the reasons that people went West. You talk about manifest destiny, this idea that the West was this place where dreams would come true, where there was this kind of unfolding or fruition of a kind of utopian ideology. You think about the West, you think about the cowboy, vigilante justice, the place of the wild, wild West. So what do we get when we have a space like California? We have the kind of culmination and amalgamation of a culture that says we have a utopian vision of the world as it could or should be. People come to the West, remember, for the gold rush. People come to the West to try out their dreams in Los Angeles of becoming famous. So there's this kind of vision of making it big. you have this vision of vigilante culture, this idea of the West as the wild final frontier. And out of that, you I think, start to see the growth of a sort of ideology that we should move fast and break things, that there is a kind of lawlessness of the West. You see it in the intellectual property. You see it in the intellectual property law. You see it in the culture, and you see it in Silicon Valley, which is, I think, a modern iteration of the wild, wild West. Now, there's a lot of exciting things about the wild, wild West. You could see it in a Western, that it is, you know, full of action. But I think that one thing that you get in the wild, wild West is this idea that, you know, anything goes, that there is the opportunity for a kind of this vigilante culture. And when we talk about move fast and break things, I think we really have to think about, you know, whether or not our modern culture should be the wild, wild West, and whether or not the outcomes of that kind of culture that is the kind of world that we want to continue to live in. To my view, the answer is no.
Yeah, there are certainly trade-offs. That by moving fast, you get things done. You get a product out that solves some kind of problem. It might, as you have pointed out, and we've mentioned a few times on this show, have unintended consequences that are, you know, of minor order severity or large order severity, that if you talked to some of those early day Wild Wild West technologists, they would say, we can fix that. We'll get to that. But what, so the trade-off is you might get something out there, but you might have to worry about tinkering with it. You also might have to worry about whether it can be fixed at all. The other thing that I think you talked about, you know, good schools and good resources. Famously, some of those early folks rejected academia altogether, right? We had Bill Gates, who went off with Ballmer to start Microsoft. We had Larry and Sergey going off to start Google, leaving Stanford to do so, because academia, in some ways, I think they might have said at the time, put constraints on them, didn't provide them with the environment that they needed to move forward and build their product. I feel like that is shifting somewhat. And some of what, particularly Cal Poly, with its emphasis on learning by doing, which is a really cool, unique approach for a university to take. And I think one that more and more universities are starting to adopt, that they might be trying to create a more incubator-like environment for students while they're still there and still able to consult with, you know, your wonderfully interdisciplinary kind of team of folks at the Ethical Technology Project, for example, so that they don't have to just go out into the wild, wild west wilderness and form their idea without baking it fully, that they can get a little bit more front end consideration and then go forth and maybe create something that's maybe not having to be fixed down the road. Do you see that too?
Yeah, there's a lot there in what you've just said. I mean, the person that you didn't mention alongside Sergey Brin, for example, or Bill Gates, is Elizabeth Holmes. Mm-hmm. I am watching The Dropout right now. Right? This is the kind of epicenter of what you're talking about. And of course, you know, you can have Bill Gates drop out, you can have Sergey Brin drop out and build a tremendous company that has been tremendously monetizable. Of course, one could argue the inverse, which is to say that some of the sciences that these folks are working on, there's a reason why, for example, in biotechnology, many of the people who are winning Nobel Prizes or, you know, coming up with these fundamentally important new innovations are in their like 60s. And the reason is that these things actually take a fair amount of expertise to build and to build well. And that it takes some time to get the proper training to do that. I think that increasingly what we are seeing with people who have dropped out, the Mark Zuckerbergs, is that they build a product that can make a lot of money and that can get a lot of traction. The good that these products are doing is, to my mind, questionable. At times, I'm not sure that these products are good for us. Now, in order to understand whether the products are good for us, I think we have to start off with really understanding the nature of the good. That's something that I try and teach in a class my college, right? So I think that that's something that education could potentially build in addition to the lab environment.
Yeah.
But now having said that, you know, I do think that there is a disregard on some levels for expertise in the kind of vision of Silicon Valley, particularly mm-hmm. the technological sector broadly, especially in the leadership. Again, I think that this has to do with incentive structures. One venture capitalist I was talking to, you know, I asked him, well, how do you decide what to invest in? He said, I look for the movie. You look for the movie. What does that mean? You look for the story, right? Not the technology that's the most interesting or that is the most life-saving or that potentially has the, you know, most ability to impact and uplift human lives. Look for the story, because that's what's going to make money. So if we want to talk about technological production and how we get back on the right track of technological production, by the right track, I mean the ethical track, I think we have to think about the incentive structure. Now, the part two of your question has to do with education itself and what education is ideally meant to do. Mm-hmm. I'm a humanist, so I come from a background where many people in my camp think that the value of education really is to teach people to be thoughtful, critically thinking human beings, to be good citizens, to be thoughtful, kind citizens, to be able to identify problems in culture and to think about, you know, important solutions to that culture. And I want to say that that has intrinsic value. It's not going to probably make somebody a ton of money, but I think it has intrinsic value. The problem is, and I think that this is a problem that the academy really has to grapple with, which is that, you know, if college were free, I think say that that's an absolutely profound value to have. And that is in and itself a justification for getting an education. But college is not free. It is notoriously, famously expensive and astronomically so. And the students that I really care about are oftentimes students who are paying their own tuition, who don't have family wealth, who don't have the ability once they graduate to get an unpaid internship or live at home for a significant period of time until they can get in the proper networks and then get in a job that's ultimately going to give them upward mobility in an industry and make them money. They have to take a job that will pay the rent. And they are graduating with a ton of debt. And I really grapple with how I can ask students to take on a ton of debt in a discipline that may never give them a pathway to a job. And so one of the things that I'm hoping to do with the Ethical Technology Initiative, and one of the things that I think is really important for us to think about as we think about education, and also as we think about the technological workforce, is to think about what we're training our students to do and how we can create pathways that offer opportunities for students and an important, you know, chance to make an impact. What I think that the ethical technology frontier does, and what I hope that my initiative will do, is it will give students the opportunity to both think critically about our society and enter into an incredibly lucrative and incredibly important workforce where they can make a difference. And I think that that is an ideal place to both transform our society, to transform the products that we all create and use, and also to transform the model of education.
Yeah, I mean, that's really wonderful the way you put that. And I answered, I think, the question that I was forming in my head. Do you see them, your students ideally becoming more entrepreneurial when they exit your watch, or going more into a conventional kind of workforce environment? And I think your answer is probably both, depending on the student and their vision and their wants, needs, and resources in life. Do you want to speak to that before we move on?
Yeah, I think, you know, what my students do once they leave is up to them. And again, contingent on a bunch of things. You know, mm-hmm. I am a person who spent a lot of time on my career, and that has been great for me. But that's not for everybody. There's people who want to live a good life where they earn a living and spend their time on their family. And that is absolutely okay. I think that right now in our culture, we define ourselves based on what we do, and what we do becomes who we are. That is not the model that I would ever want to advocate for. My model is primarily, you know, think about who you want to be as a person holistically. Where do you want to live? Who do you want to be around? What kind of family do you want to have? And then you could build out from there. I think that there is a tremendous place for people to make an impact professionally, but that's not the only place that people can make an impact. We're not our titles. We're not our jobs. We're not the things that we have accomplished or built. We're the kind of people that we are. And those kinds of people exist in every single, you know, industry, across every single kind of opportunity. I think the part of the question that you asked that deals specifically with how I'm training my students is something that I would answer by saying that I'm not, you know, delusional about the tech industry. I talk to a lot of tech CEOs and I talk to a lot of tech workers. And I think that there's some really good CEOs out there. But I think that to be a CEO, you kind of have to be aggressive. And you kind of have to not care too much about ethics, or at least care about them a little bit less than you care about profit. And so if I'm talking to students and I'm teaching students who are really earnest about their ethical impulse, I think it's very unlikely that they will become a CEO of a massively profitable company. And this is not to denigrate CEOs. If you're a CEO of a publicly traded company, then your primary obligation legally is to your shareholders. Again, we come back to the incentive structure around what, you know, leaders in the industry are tempted to do, what they are allowed to do, and what they are incentivized to do. But if my students are thoughtful people, I don't know that they will ever become a CEO. They might become a good, strong, you know, worker, and they might raise ethical objections or try and do their best. I'm not sure that they will ultimately become a leader of the company. And that is perfectly okay. That is perfectly okay to work and to do a good job and to feel like you have done your best at the end of the day and you're making a living for your family. So I'm not sure if that's the answer that you, right. you want. But
no, yeah. I think you absolutely have summed that up. There is, of course, this whole field of enterprise, and I forget what the corporate catchphrase of the day is for it now, but corporations who are not just out to make a profit, but are their profit margin is hand in hand tied to their ability to do good things in the world.
Right. So what you're talking about there is something mm-hmm. like a B Corp, if you're talking yeah. about the legal term. And if you're talking about the broad cultural terminology around it, it's something like corporate responsibility. Mm-hmm. And increasingly companies are at least feeling the pressure, if not feeling the obligation to be responsible as a corporation. And certainly, I think that my generation and the generation of my students who are buying products or who are thinking about where they want to put their talent are increasingly interested in making sure that the company is aligned with their values. And to that end, we have a really neat moment where, you know, incentive structures are somewhat aligned between what a company is incentivized to do in terms of developing its business model toward a kind of corporate responsibility, and what the kind of culture is edging people to do toward a kind of ethical responsibility.
Okay, let's look at a couple of examples in the technological realm that desperately need ethics and responsibility applied to them as they unfold at a rapid pace in our world. The first of which being artificial intelligence, which is going to be so enormously important to humanity going forward. We are at the inception of its significance, its very, very formative natal stages. We have not achieved anything approaching artificial general intelligence yet, meaning intelligence that would be equivalent to what you and I can do sitting here today. And thank goodness we have not approached anything like an artificial super intelligence. But folks are hard at work, daily, hourly, grinding away to those ends. In the interim, before we get to those large milestones, AI makes all kinds of other decisions in our lives about what sort of ads we're going to see, what sort of analysis is going to be done with our image by a government entity, et cetera. So there's all kinds of near-term and I think longer-term really significant ramifications of this entire field of study and development. And I guess after framing it for you here, I would like to know, what is your biggest hope for AI and what is your biggest fear as we sit here today?
Oh, that's a big question. There's a lot of different directions that I could take that. Let's start with the fears with AI. I think that increasingly, I guess I would back up in a second and say, well, what exactly is artificial intelligence? And on a very basic colloquial level, artificial intelligence essentially takes a process and it automates that process, right? On a very basic level. And you can do this on all sorts of more sophisticated levels, everything from, you know, phone trees to something like your Siri, right? Or, you know, the science fiction dimensions of AI as, you know, semi-sentient human beings, as a recent Google engineer feared it to be. I think that my fear with AI has, you know, my major fear with AI right now in this particular moment has less to do with how AI is itself deployed, and more to do with the literacy around what AI is. What we saw with the engineer at Google was a person who essentially confused AI with a human being. And I think that human beings are increasingly doing that. So what I'm not saying is that I'm worried that AI will become sentient. I'm worried that this technology has developed so substantially and with such sophistication that human beings really don't know at this point, and as this gets more sophisticated, we'll not know how we ought to interact with that. And that can become quite dangerous. I'm not talking again about the danger of human beings falling in love with an AI. But if your AI, for example, on Facebook prompts you to mobilize toward a specific political division, or if you have increasingly sophisticated AI, you know, giving politically persuasive commentary or prompting you towards specific content, human beings don't know, like necessarily at this moment, that that's an AI bot and not a human doing that. And because we have a capacity in literary studies, in poetry, you know, we call this tendency, you know, somewhere along the lines of personification of inanimate objects and anthropomorphism, we tend to animate an entity that responds to us with the qualities of having a perceived human mind at the other end. Of course, AI does not have a perceived human mind at the other end, but when it starts to give us responses that to us indicate sentience, even if it is not sentient, we treat it as though it were sentient. That means that when we're treating an AI as though it were sentient, we're treating its arguments as though those were valid arguments to which we should respond. We are mobilized or moved to certain feelings. Empathy might be a good one, but of course, anger is another one, to act as though these implied minds were suggesting that we do certain things. And I don't think that we have the digital literacy for that at this point. I don't think that we have the capability to distinguish that in the broader public yet. So that is my concern. We can just think about how that would play out in a political arena when, for example, you have bots, you know, telling you to vote for a certain person, or that perhaps an election is stolen or invalid. And I think that that sows the seeds of massive chaos. My hope, go ahead.
Oh, I think you're right onto something there, and that we have proven time after time as we've interacted with new technologies that have been unleashed on the world, that humanity needs time with them before it can relate to them intelligently. Digital literacy, as you said, back when email was first unleashed on the world, I remember well, and my neighbor was reminding me, gee, isn't it nice that we don't all forward those chain emails anymore that used to clog up our email inboxes and mostly annoy the heck out of us, unless you were that really unique kind of human who enjoyed those. And we have sort of evolved past, okay, if I've gotten one of these, first of all, we have filters that pretty much keep them away from us now. And secondly, if you get one somehow, you know that, gee, I'm not going to send this on to 20 of my tenuously related friends so that at the end of the day, I get some nice recipes or whatever the thing was that it dangled at the end. So we had to work through that. And that's a very innocuous example. You know, you're talking about some very much more culturally and socially dire examples of, you know, can our democracy withstand certain things as opposed to just our kitchens and our time. So I think that's a really important point to bear in mind with any technological tool that folks are expected to use, relate to, be subjected to, whether it's email or artificial intelligence or automation, that there has to be an educational and an experiential component of getting to a place of less idiocy and that needs to be built into an evolutionary path of any tech. And we're certainly not there with AI, as you point out.
Yeah, I think that in general, our technological production is ramped up so quickly and it evolves so quickly. The human brain does not have the ability to evolve at the pace of our technologies. I'm not the first person to suggest this. But I think a famous example is, you know, Orson Welles's broadcast of War of the Worlds, very famous story of an alien takeover. One could argue that what Orson Welles was concerned about, what he wanted the panic to be about, was not that aliens from outside of our terrestrial sphere would descend onto Earth and cause massive terror, but that there was a very dangerous domestic challenge to the social order. And that challenge was the invasion of the radio itself, a technological device that was, at the time that Wells broadcast War of the Worlds in the United States, was broadcasting propaganda in Germany, to the tremendous effect of disseminating anti-Semitism and Hitler's broader propaganda scheme across Germany. Wells saw the radio as a form of new technology that was destabilizing fact and fiction. And he broadcast War of the Worlds ostensibly as a concern, you know, about alien invasions or a kind of prank about, you know, causing mass hysteria over this kind of ludicrous fiction or science fiction premise. But he was really concerned about, and many people were very concerned about Americans and the broader public not knowing how the radio could kind of seam together facts and fictions, and in so doing, sow the seeds of a propaganda war by a bad actor. So I'm not the first person to think about the ways that our technologies may be growing at a pace faster than our ability to keep up with their literacy or our literacy to be able to understand them. But I did want to respond to the hope, because I don't want to have all of this be doom and gloom. Mm-hmm. And I do think that one thing that I hypothesize about with our AI products is that this implied humanness on the other side of the aisle, on the non-human realm, I think one could make a plausible case is expanding or changing the calculus of how human beings think about our obligations to the non-human world, broadly speaking. So when we're talking about the implied humanity of AI, I think that this knocks many people out of a kind of comfortable sphere of seeing ethics as, or ethical obligations as, only relevant to other human beings. To me, it's not an accident that at the same time we're having conversations about whether or not AI is sentient and whether or not we might owe some ethical obligations to that form of sentience were we to designate it as sentient. We're having new conversations about whether or not we have ethical obligations to non-human animals or potentially to the planet. And I think that these are critical conversations. To my mind, they are absolutely connected to one another. I think that they feed into and inform one another. And my hope, as somebody who cares very deeply about the ethics of the planet and the ethics of non-human animals, is that the conversations that we're having about sentience, broadly speaking, and what constitutes sentience and what ethical obligations we may owe to non-human sentience gets directed and channeled into thinking about these other very important terms, and that the conversations we have about AI can influence our thinking about the non-human world and our ethical relationship to it.
There's some discussion out in the world about whether it's a good idea for folks working in the AI arena to have to take something similar to the medical field's Hippocratic Oath. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, let's go back to thinking about the Hippocratic Oath and more recently, the field of bioethics, which emerged not coincidentally in the latter half of the 20th century. And the reason that the field of bioethics emerged was that medical ethics had become deeply suspect in the wake of the Holocaust, when it was revealed that people like Joseph Mengele had conducted experiments on human beings that were deeply, deeply grotesque and unethical. And, you know, subsequent studies looked at, well, why did the general population, accept the kind of horrors of the Holocaust? And why were people like Joseph Mengele capable of operating as they did? How was somebody like Joseph Mengele not capable of seeing the grotesqueness of what he was doing? And a lot of, you know, I'll give you an example of one famous study that I think makes the point. The study asked one group of people to deliver shocks to another group of people that they could visibly see. And the shocks, of course, were not real, but the people who were receiving these shocks were informed to act as though they were in deep pain as a result of receiving these shocks. The group was resistant to causing harm to this other group of people, the group of people asked to deliver the shocks. But then they were told that if they were to deliver these shocks to the other group of people, it would be for the benefit of science, that there would be some sort of scientific benefit to what they were doing. And the idea that there was a scientific benefit to causing harm to other people was enough to mobilize this group of people to cause that harm. So what does this tell us? It tells us that we as human beings generally believe that scientific progress is good and that things done in the name of scientific progress are on some level worth the cost or worth the harm. And so I think that on that level, we have to be very careful about this kind of utopian thinking that we tend to associate with science and that we tend to associate with technological production. We tend to think of it as inherently progressive, inherently good. I think that the framework of bioethics and the field of bioethics was developed to put up some safeguards, knowing that science itself is kind of sold in our society as inherently good. That, I think, is the modern day rationale behind the Hippocratic Oath and the structures that are now in place around things like consent in the medical sphere, or things like regulations around how you can test on subjects or how you can subject other human beings to forms of testing in the name of science. So I think that we should have not only a Hippocratic Oath in the field of bioethics, but I think that we also need a sphere of ethical, technological thinking as well. And I say that with one caveat, which is that we can't stop, I think, at the edges of ethical thinking when it comes to technological production, just as the field of bioethics does not stop at determining and, you know, mulling over the particularities of ethics. I think we actually need a framework for digital ethics and a kind of Hippocratic oath that is tethered to legal implications. You might ask what the relationship is between law and ethics. And sometimes I explain that as law is everything that ethics typically is not. When we think about ethics, we think about what we ought to do, what we should do. If I stop at a red light, that's not ethical. I'm just following the law. I'm following a rule. Ethics, I think many people would argue, is a question of what ought we to do? What should we do in the space where there is no rules? And where I land on that is that I think that we should actually have rules. So one way to think about laws is codified ethics with a set of restrictions and punishments for disobeying those codified ethics. And I think that a conversation about ethics and the kind of oath, if you want to call it that, ought to be maneuvered toward an ultimate outcome of laws and regulations, not just ethical thinking.
Yeah. So what you're saying is an oath is nice. It frames the discussion, but we need it to have teeth and we need laws too.
I think so.
Yeah.
Laws, regulation, permitting.
Right. So we'll see what happens in the EU, which is in the process of enacting its AI Act, which does have some teeth. And I think wants technologists to have to turn over source code on demand and have to be able to disable systems that the oversight bodies have deemed are running amok in some way. So that will be an interesting experiment to see what direct regulation of AI looks at. Let's, as long as we're traveling around the world a bit, let's talk about China and let's talk about young people and that ethics point that you just raised, you know, the things we should do and the things we choose to do and the things maybe other societies choose to do differently. If we raise a generation of very interdisciplinarily informed young new business members of society, and they're making ethical decisions about how data is gathered, how it is stored, whether it needs to be used at all in the service of whatever they're trying to accomplish in their business, we will be going in a direction very different than our neighbors over in China, where the government is hoovering up as much data about its populace as it can, and to God knows what ends ultimately. One thing we know has happened there recently, just this week, is the police in Shanghai had a database that apparently was hacked. The Chinese government has not acknowledged this yet, but there seems, if you look at reporting in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, there seems to be good authority that this hack, in fact, took place, that the data was out there, that the data was actually out there for longer than anyone knew. But the reason it came to light recently is someone attempted to sell it. This is data on more than a billion Chinese citizens in a police database. So it could be, you know, what sort of threat they're deemed to be to the Chinese government, of course, their police records, et cetera. So there's an article in Fortune by Grady McGregor this week positing that this kind of massive data leak was inevitable based on the sheer volume of data that China is collecting about its citizens. So I guess what we're seeing is an example of ethics checked at the door and playing out in their society. And what we'd like to see not happen here, of course, but it does raise the question, number one, what can we do about other countries and governments who choose to go in a completely what we would consider unethical direction? And should we be worried that there's nothing we can do?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's two separate questions. The first is, what can we do? Mm-hmm. There was a series of protocols put in place in the middle of the last century that tried to create a global infrastructure around, in particular, human rights, right? We call that the United Nations in its common iteration. We call the protocols that they were developed, the Human Rights Charter. And that was an attempt to bind a global community around the protection of human rights and also the enforcement of human rights. We have not seen that hold up particularly well. I think that Putin's attack on Ukraine has, in specific violation of the Nuremberg Tribunal, has really demonstrated the lack of teeth that the international community has around protecting human rights in this particular moment, and a real, like, I think, reckoning about whether or not there is a global community that is even capable of enforcing human rights, even if there were the will to do so or the social capital to do so. And many times those are one in the same in countries that have elections where they get to tell their legislators what to vote for and what to stand behind. I think that in the context of China, you know, China does not operate with the same framework of human rights that the United Nations envisioned. There is a real question, I think, about whether or not human rights is a priority in China or whether it is a value in China. I am not an expert on China. I think that this is a particularly nuanced area that I'm probably not qualified to delve deeply into. But certainly, if you don't start off with the premise of human rights as an absolute essential, axiomatic value of the culture, then your laws and your regulations and your decisions about how to treat citizens and citizen privacy issues very differently forth from that than it does in a place where human rights in the absolute sovereignty of the individual rights of that person, and I should say the particular sovereignty of the individual to have privacy rights to begin with, is then made relevant. And that is just not the case in China. So I don't know that there is anything that the international community can do. Whether the international community should do something is a matter far beyond whether or not the international community wants to enforce data privacy rights in China. It delves into issues of diplomacy, issues of questions about, you know, what the relationship right now with the United States and China would allow it to do in the first place, questions of the international implications of all of that. Now, we can set that aside and we can say, well, what are the implications of that historical event, if this data privacy breach has happened, for how we should think about data privacy in the United States? Our government certainly collects a lot of data about us. If there is a breach to the United States government, we are all deeply imperiled. But we also have a kind of deep separation between corporate enterprise and government enterprise that China does not have as divisively. And in the United States, I have to say that I would probably be more worried about, for example, a data breach at Google or a data breach at Facebook than I am about, you know, a data breach with the United States government. Don't get me wrong, we should be concerned about all of these things. But I would say that the extent to which Google has, in a sense, a kind of very trenchant grasp on my daily movements through my commercial behavior, through my browsing behavior, that I'm not sure that the United States government actually has in terms of the amount of data that Google may have on me. I'd be worried about a kind of a corporate breach as much so, if not more so, than I am about a government breach in the United States.
Right. That's setting aside Edward Snowden type information about the US government's access to databases within private companies and how there's some fluidity there. Yeah, go ahead.
And I would just add one last paragraph of thought that I'm not sure that I'm just worried about a data breach. Frankly, yeah. I'm worried about the data that's held about me currently that is unbreached and what, you know, a company is doing with that data in terms of manipulating my behavior or moving my behavior in certain dimensions that are efficacious for it. If a company's interest is its bottom line, And it has no, you know, broader ambition, or it has no broader, I shouldn't even use the word ambition, obligation toward civic values in the first place. That data, you know, I think is as harmful in many ways as unbreached as it is breached.
Right. Yeah. And just to end our discussion about data, I think that I'm very optimistic about Gen Z and Gen Alpha as they come up and will be more exposed to education about privacy and what data they should share with whom. I'm optimistic about our governments finally moving in that direction to where we have some privacy protections codified in the United States in a more aggressive way than simply looking for such protections in various clauses of the United States Constitution. And so I have great hope for those youngsters, but I also watch them flip endlessly through TikTok. So I think we have an interesting dichotomy there.
I would say, you know, I am hopeful for Gen Z always because I teach students, and I think mm-hmm. that I feel so fortunate that I'm working with people who are some of the brightest and most, I think, thoughtful and also, you know, really action-oriented people. But I will say that in this particular moment, I'm not as optimistic about privacy. I don't want to in any way minimize the very real effect that the erosion or the overturning of Roe versus Wade has on people with uteruses, women, reproductive rights. But Roe versus Wade was decided on the basis of privacy. Mm-hmm. And it was decided on the basis of an inherent right to privacy. And one thing that I think that we should be thinking about more, again, not to overshadow the real imperiled issues of reproductive rights for women and people with uteruses, but the implications for privacy. There are enormous implications for privacy. Privacy as a concept, privacy as a sovereign value that the government cannot intrude into or intervene into. Privacy in terms of how information about you can be used to prosecute you or to imperil your ability to live your life. So these are issues that, you know, Roe versus Wade also deeply imperils. And I hope that we're thinking about those things too. I think that there is an increasing amount of pressure on privacy and individual privacy by our Supreme Court specifically and by the government broadly. And I think that we should be paying attention to how decisions like Roe versus Wade are not just tethered to abortion, which of course they are, and women and people with uteruses, reproductive rights, which of course they are, but broader philosophical questions about the privacy of our citizenry itself.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it's so important for anybody who is concerned about these issues as well to pay attention to who your elected representatives are and what they're doing, because those people need to go forth and protect these interests. I think we're getting down to the wrapping up our discussion here. One thing we'd like to do here on Uneven Distribution is conclude with a facepalm of the week. And Deb has given us a great one this week. This is a situation. Before we go on, I just wanted to frame what my facepalm of the week sort of envisions. And what that is tech that's been mismanaged or resulted in unintended consequences, or maybe been applied to a situation where tech wasn't the proper solution at all. And I think that that's what we've got going on here. Why don't you tell us, Deb, about the PR2 robot that was at least discussed as a solution and possibly even purchased by the city of San Francisco, correct?
Yeah, so this is not a current facepalm of the week, but I think that this is the facepalm to and all weeks. It is a robot that was developed by technological geniuses in the Silicon Valley area. And these robots were developed to try and solve a problem that San Francisco as the city faces and has faced for quite some time now, which is that given the increasing homeless population in the city, there is buildup of obviously unwanted human feces. The homeless population in San Francisco is frequently not accountable to the city. I'm fairly certain I would feel similarly if I had been treated by the city in the way that the homeless population has been treated. So I'm very sympathetic to the homeless population. Residents of San Francisco found themselves dealing with a problem of feces left by a homeless population in San Francisco. This technological firm developed robots that were specifically designed to be able to detect human feces on the street and to pick up those feces and bring them to repositories, which was marketed as a brilliant technological solution to this very challenging problem. Of course, I, coming from my background as a humanist, would say that a better solution to this problem of feces on the streets of San Francisco is something that San Francisco also doesn't have, which is a number of public restrooms that people can use to go to the bathroom with dignity and to have a place to go to the bathroom if you don't have a home that doesn't require you to buy something from a merchant or from a place of business in order to use the restroom facilities. So my solution would have been public restrooms. I think that the idea that the proper solution to this problem is a very expensive technological fix is indicative of a culture that thinks of technological fixes before it thinks of the human dimension. And I think that if I were to give one kind of solid piece of advice to end the conversation, it would be let's foreground the human dimension. Oftentimes, human problems require human solutions. I don't mean to eschew technology. I love technology, but let's think about the human dimension of our problems first. Let's try and solve for the human rather than find the techno fix.
Yes. And while technology may play some role in solving the overarching and very pernicious problem of homelessness throughout the United States, this is probably not the proper role. This particular device was $400,000 per poop picker upper and actually had an acronym, Poop Scoop, which stood for Perception of Offensive Products and Sensorized Control of Object Pickup. So if that, you can't make that up.
No. If you have a seventh season of Silicon Valley, here you go. This is some material.
Absolutely. Well, Deb, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. I have learned a lot, and I'm sure our audience has as well. We really appreciate you joining us here on An Uneven Distribution. We wish you amazing luck and continued success with your Technically Human podcast, which I encourage everyone to go check out. You cover great topics there, much along the lines of what we've delved into today. Is there anything else that's coming up for you that you'd like to plug or highlight before we go ahead and conclude?
Oh, I wanted to just thank you, first of all, Denise, so much for having me on the show. It's a delight to talk to you. And of course, it's a pleasure to get to talk about these issues that I think about all the time. You can check out the Technically Human podcast. We are off for the summer. We are starting up again in September with new dimensions of the Technically Human podcast and a special series that I'm delighted to announce. We are doing a series called 22 Lessons on Ethical Technology for the 21st Century, where we interview 22 major thinkers from around the world about all of the different dimensions and pockets of ethics and technology that affect our lives. And in addition to that, I'm also very excited to announce the Uncovered podcast, which is a true crime serial where we look at the intersection of tech and the criminal justice system through the lens of one story and through the story of one particular person, a victim named Georgia Leah Moses, a girl who was killed in 1997 and whose case we want to reopen to investigation using new technological forms and really thinking about how our technologies frame and change what we think about as evidence, what we think about as human rights, and what we understand to be facts in service of a claim. So you can check out those things. Otherwise, please continue to listen to Denise's show. She's got great questions and is creating a really great conversation. I'm really excited to hear more of what you do. Oh,
thank you so much. It's been thrilling to have you as my first guest here at Uneven Distribution. As William Gibson famously said, the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. And I think that we've explored a number of those areas today. Thank you so much, Deb, for joining me.
Thanks again, Denise.
All right. So with that, we'll go ahead and do our little video promo and I'll let you go. That went really well, I think.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Thanks so much for hosting me again. And thanks so much for these thoughtful questions and for all your research.
Oh, my pleasure. All right. So let's see. We covered poop scooping robots, the modern day tech Wild West. And what else can we throw in there?
Tech and human rights.
Yes. All right. And what I usually try and do, or what I did with my prior show, is give the show a name. I don't know if we're going to do that here or not. Just seeing if anything comes to me. How about ethics, oaths, and Orwell?
Sounds great.
All right. Go ahead and do it with and without the name and see what my network wants to do with that.
You could also just, I mean, you're welcome to use technically human if you want to use it.
No. I mean, a name for each. We could use technically human as the name for this episode. Yes.
Right.
All right. That is a thought. Okay. Hi there. Next up on the Hearsay Culture Network, we've got Uneven Distribution with our guest this week, Deb Donick. Deb co-leads the Ethical Technology Project at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. I always stumble over San Luis Obispo. Let me try that again. It's a tongue twister. Thank you for joining us here at the Hearsay Culture Network. You're about to join us for Uneven Distribution. Our guest this week is Dr. Deb Donick. She co-leads the, one more time. Hi there, Denise Howell here from the Hearsay Culture Network. You're about to join us for Uneven Distribution, and our guest this week is Dr. Deb Donick. She co-leads the Ethical Technology Project at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and hosts the Technically Human podcast. Hi, Deb. How are you doing today?
Oh, hi, Denise. It's great to be here.
Good. I'm so excited for our discussion. I know our listeners are going to love it, too. We covered the modern-day tech Wild West, AI's potential downsides, tech and global human rights, and poop scooping robots. You guys aren't going to want to miss it. Stay tuned. All right, that's one we might be able to use. Let me try one other lead in for us. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. You're here at the Hearsay Culture Network, about to listen to Uneven Distribution. My guest this week is Dr. Deb Donig. She is the co-lead of the Ethical Technology Project at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and she hosts the Technically Human podcast. Hey, Deb, thanks for joining me.
Oh, hi, Denise. It's great to be here.
So our show this week is called Ethics, Oaths, and Orwell. We're going to cover modern day tech. One more time. Let's try this from the top. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're here at the Hearsay Culture Network. You're about to join us for Uneven Distribution, and my guest this week is Dr. Deb Donig, the co-lead of the Ethical Technology Project at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and host of the Technically Human podcast. Hey, Deb.
Hi, Denise. Great to be here.
Great to have you. I can't wait for our audience to enjoy this show. It's called Ethics, Oaths, and Orwell this week. We cover modern day tech Wild West shenanigans, AI's potential upsides and downsides, tech and global human rights, and poop scooping robots. You're not going to want to miss it. Stay tuned. All right, I think that gives them something to work with. Thank you for bearing with me.
Oh, no problem. I am very familiar with recording introductions and promos.
Yes.
It takes me a lot of takes sometimes.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you, Denise, so much for hosting me and for these questions. Really enjoyed it. Let me know if you need anything else from me.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. And I'll let you know as soon as the show is out and available. Take care.
Sounds good. Ciao. Okay. I'll advertise it on my networks.
All righty. Bye-bye.